If Trump works out a decent relationship by talking to the Russians, well, peace is not good for business. War tensions with Russia are very, very convenient for the arms makers, the arms sellers, who make huge profits, who give a share of those profits to congressmen and senators. They stick it in their back pockets. They use it to win their next campaign. They appropriate more money for the arms trade. Man, is this a great country or what? That's the way it works.
Housing, I dare say, from my favorite First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, is a human right, all right? And it's applicable to healthcare, that they run like a business. I think this is part of the biggest struggle, and I think that we start right here with the housing issue, and it would really snowball to a lot of other things that would be beneficial to the common good.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and as always, we have a lot packed into our hour. The nation's capital was filled with protests and all types of activism this week, opposing AIPAC and Israeli apartheid, fighting for single-payer health care or Medicare for all, fighting for police accountability and community control of the police. But still, the corporate media is focusing on the war of investigations going on between the Democrats and Republicans. Today, we'll be speaking with former CIA analyst turned human rights activist Ray McGovern, who says that the surveillance state is the real story of Russiagate. Also, a forum held here in D.C. this week about community land trusts as an answer to preserving affordable housing in this country. All that is coming up, but first, some headlines. In environmental news, there are both new challenges from the Trump regime and some significant victories. This week, President Trump signed an executive order that would expand drilling and mining on public lands and nullify President Obama's Clean Power Plan to close hundreds of coal-fired plants, freeze construction of new plants, and replace them with renewable energy. Trump's latest order is on top of a proposed 31% cut in the Environmental Protection Agency's budget, and a Trump directive that might weaken motor vehicle energy efficiency standards. Mustafa Ali, who was senior advisor and associate assistant administrator for environmental justice at the EPA until he recently resigned, told On the Ground what Trump's rollback of environmental protections means for vulnerable communities.
By rolling back the Clean Power Plan, if that comes into being, I think that this is a direct assault on our communities. And shows that the values and priorities that our new administration has are markedly different from those of everyday folks who in some instances are just surviving.
One vulnerable community, Flint, Michigan, did score a victory this week in a settlement that will require the state of Michigan to provide nearly $100 million to Flint for replacement of Flint's lead service lines. The agreement also requires the state to maintain a door-to-door water filtration installation and education program to extensively monitor Flint's tap water for lead and to continue to make bottled water available to Flint residents. One of the victorious plaintiffs, the Reverend Alan Overton, who spoke to On the Ground last year, said of the settlement, "The water issue must be resolved before we can make Flint thrive again, and I believe this resolution offers a path to a healthier, less traumatic future for everyone in Flint." Another victory for those concerned about water safety and the climate was scored here in the D.C. area when Maryland's Governor Larry Hogan signed legislation that will ban fracking in the state. In Black Lives Matter news, people are continuing to meet here in D.C. to draw attention to the disproportionate number of black children in the district who are missing and whose cases remain unsolved. In recent weeks, there have been several gatherings to address the issue, including one this week on March 29th, when Christine White of Black Millennials for Flint addressed the crowd at the African-American Civil War Memorial in Northwest D.C.
The media reports on issues they feel are important, and missing young Black girls do not receive the same kind of coverage as the missing young white girl. Historically, selective reporting has taken place, and it's up to us as a community to hold the media's feet to the fire along with authorities by showing, like right now, at this rally, that we care about our Black children.
Two more Black Lives Matter actions are planned in D.C. for Saturday, April 1st. And in the second half of the show, we'll be hearing voices on a grassroots strategy to counter the skyrocketing cost of housing, which is impacting not only the District of Columbia, but many cities and regions across the country. But right now, we're going to shift gears and go international to international headlines as they impact the United States. And for that, I'm welcoming back Professor of History and African American Studies, Gerald Horn. Good morning, Gerald. Oh, okay. Well, while we get him back, we will... Oh, is he back? Oh, good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
Okay. So a lot of us have had it up to here with these Russia stories and corporate media, but I'm coming to you to get some of the news that we're probably missing, little known news, as we call it, involving the Trump regime, and especially news involving, you know, the United States and overseas that we're not hearing in all the, or seeing in all the Russia fog. We're having a problem with the connection for some reason. We should probably try to connect with you again. And we have a brief sound from Cornel West speaking at the anti-AIPAC rally held this week, and we're going to play that, and then we'll try to connect with Gerald Horn again.
We come from a very rich and deep prophetic tradition. It goes back to Amos and Jeremiah and Esther. It goes back to Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Albert Einstein and Murray Rookheiser and so many others. And so we tell some of our more conservative brothers and sisters on the inside that you do not represent the best of the Jewish prophetic tradition, and we hear the bell witness.
So that was Cornel West speaking at the protest held earlier this week against the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, the Zionist organization AIPAC, and they were also protesting for Palestinian rights and that Israel respect Palestinian rights and its apartheid state. So let me get back to Gerald. It's eaten up so much of our time, our technical problems, but what are some of the maybe two stories that we've been missing in all this Russia fog?
Well, in the interest of time, I'll mention one, Sebastian Gorka, who we've talked about quite a bit on the ground. He's a member of the national security team of President Trump. He only became a U.S. citizen a few years ago. He was formerly a member of the national security establishment of both Britain and Hungary, and his roots are in Hungary. It turns out that he has very suspicious ties to right-wing, even neo-fascist organizations in Hungary. The Jewish Weekly out of New York, The Forward, has been focusing on that. It has not broken into the mainstream press, at least from my reading, except for mentioned by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times just a few days ago. I think that this deserves quite a bit of attention because having a neo-fascist in the Trump administration team seems to me, even to outdo Donald Trump, an outrageousness.
Wow. Well, we'll definitely keep following that and everything else that's happening here in D.C. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
Well, related, this week, April 4th, will mark 100 years since the United States Senate voted to enter World War I and 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous speech against war, and a group called World Beyond War is having events all around the country to mark what they call a new movement to end all war. And this is at the same time that the U.S. is bombing Mosul. There were several news stories this week about hundreds of civilians being killed in a single airstrike, and also the U.S. Looking to take a greater role in Yemen, where millions of people are facing famine and are really under the guns of U.S.-backed war. So that's coming up. And look forward to that. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, Ray McGovern on what's really happening with Congress, the White House, and Russia. Stay with us.
Watching me.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam, and most of you who have been following the news from D.C. know that there is a war of investigations going on related to last year's presidential election. On one side, Democrats continue to press for an investigation into what they call collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia to hack the election. On the other side, Republicans want to investigate whether the Obama administration illegally surveilled Donald Trump. The latest development in the story remains the call by Democrats for Representative Devin Nunes, Republican of California, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, to recuse himself from the committee's investigation into whether collusion occurred between the Trump campaign and Russia. And as my father would have said, Nunes made his business bad by meeting with Trump and not his own committee members to reveal information given to him about how Trump and his team may have been surveilled. After that breach of protocol, it was revealed that Nunes was actually on the grounds of the White House where he received the information later revealed to Trump, and then he made a statement to the press. So this is all quite a morass that has been given weight to calls for a special committee or independent commission to investigate these charges or these allegations. But outside of the perspective of these two camps is a third one offered by my guest for this segment. Ray McGovern is a veteran CIA officer turned political activist who founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity in 2003. Welcome back to the show, Ray.
Thank you.
Well, this week you and Bill Binney, the NSA whistleblower, authored the article in consortiumnews.com, The Surveillance State Behind Russiagate, in which you two have a whole different take on what's happening. So I want to give you time to kind of unwind that and tell us why these competing investigations that we keep hearing about aren't the real story.
Well, thanks, Esther. I'm glad to be on your show here. What I'd like to explain is that there are basically two main investigations going on here. One is whether the Russians, very simply put, are responsible for putting Donald Trump in office. That is, whether they hacked, whether they leaked, whether they did all kinds of nefarious things to make sure that Hillary Clinton lost. It may come as a surprise to your listeners, but I can tell you, out of 55 years of experience here, half of it as an analyst for the CIA, there is not one inch, there is not one scintilla of plausible evidence that the Russians did that.
Yeah, you actually mentioned that when we spoke in December, I think.
That's right. It was clear then, and it's clear now. What we have are leaks. Two WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks is quite capable of getting leaks all by itself, thank you, and replaying it into U.S. media. Now, the thing that I didn't know last time we spoke was that President Obama himself admitted 2 days before he left office, he said, and I quote, the conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how, when and where the Russian hacking got to WikiLeaks are inconclusive. Wow, end quote. Now, if you can't prove and you can't know, as the U.S. government doesn't know, how it was that this assumed Russian hacky got to WikiLeaks, you have no case at all. That's a gaping gap. And the reason it's a gaping gap is because it wasn't the Russians. It was a leaker within the Democratic National Committee who put a little thumb drive into his computer and got that somehow to WikiLeaks. So let's let that one rest. The other one, the one that's come to the fore now, was when Donald Trump accused Obama, actually, of wiretapping him. Now, that really sounds pretty ridiculous, doesn't it? Well, on its face it is, because Obama wouldn't be the person that would order that. But what the media has done is seized upon the word wiretapping. Now, why is that significant? Well, it's significant because wiretapping sort of went out with the Edsel Ford, okay? Wiretapping is old, it's quaint, it's obsolete. Nobody does that. Nobody has done that for decades, okay? So what was Trump really referring to? I assume he was referring to surveillance. Now, did the U.S. government under President Obama do surveillance on Trump and his team before the election and after the election? The answer to that is yes. Yes, they did. Now, when did Trump make that charge? He made it on the 4th of March. And about a month earlier,
before you go to that, how do you know that, yes, they did? How do you know that?
Well, that's what I'm just about to tell you. In an interview with MSNBC's Morning Joe on the 2nd of March, 2017, a Obama official named Evelyn Farkas, that's F-A-R-K-A-S, happily admits that there was sensitive information about spying on President-elect Trump and his Trump Tower. Fox News ran the story. This is what Farkas expressed concern about. She was very concerned that, quote, Trump folks, if they found out how we knew what we knew about their staff dealing with Russians, that would be a major problem. Okay? Whoa! So I'll say it again. That Trump folks, if they knew about how we, the Obama administration, how we knew about what we knew about their dealings with the Russians, whoa, that would be a problem. Now, what does that have to do with? That has to do with intercepted communications, surveillance, that includes everyone. Everyone, Esther. You, me, Trump, the president, everyone. That's how far out of control our surveillance, our intelligence agencies are. So when I say that after this, about a month after she admitted it, no, not a month, that's March 2nd, okay, Morning Joe, it wasn't very long after that, that Trump said he was wiretapped. Now, it was a poor choice of words. He wasn't wiretapped. But what we have is James Comey indulging in what lawyers call pettifoggery. He swears up and down on a stack of Bibles that the FBI has looked everywhere, and the Department of Justice, too. They've looked everywhere, but they can find no evidence of, quote, wiretapping, end quote.
You know, I want to make sure that we make it clear to people and explain this incidental collection, because it may not be clear whether the spying or surveillance was direct, or was it related to another type of investigation going on, and then maybe Trump and some of his other people were caught up in what they call incidental collection. And explain to us how this is related to what Edward Snowden revealed to us.
Okay. Well, again, another very good question. What Americans need to know is this, that this intercepted material is available to the heads of CIA, the FBI, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and of course to NSA, which collects it, in true name. Okay? Unencrypted, not minimized, and not masked true names. Okay? And so they are able to share that with the New York Times and the Washington Post. And that is precisely what happened. So all this masking stuff, that comes later when a lowly analyst wants to pursue a certain person or event. these people had the true names, and they released them. Now, that's the crime, okay? That's the crime. Everyone is agreed about that, that you can't leak these things. And when you leak them for political purposes, which was obviously the case in October, November, and December, then you have somebody doing illegal activity. You have a crime. And that's what the focus is now. When John Brennan comes and testifies together with James Clapper, they know exactly what they did. And what Nunes is doing now, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, is getting all his ducks in a row, showing his ranking member and the ranking member and chair of the Senate side committee what the evidence is. So they know the right questions to ask John Brennan. John Brennan and James Clapper are both self-admitted prevaricators. James Clapper lied to the Senate Intelligence Committee 4 years. It's exactly 4 years ago, and he was allowed to stay in place. What happened is this. When you talk about James Clapper, who was the National Intelligence Director, and John Brennan, who is the head of the CIA, coming to testify before the House Intelligence Committee, if I were Devin Nunes, the chair of that committee, I would take every precaution to know exactly all I could before I would question them. Why? Why? Well, it's very easy. James Clapper lied under oath to the Senate Intelligence Committee exactly 4 years ago. Obama thought, well, we'll just let him stay in office. It's only got 3.5 more years, and he did. What did he say? He denied that NSA was doing any of this against any of the snooping surveillance against American citizens. 2 months later, Ed Snowden showed Clapper to be a liar. Clapper wrote a letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee saying what I said was obviously incorrect. I'm really sorry. He was let to stay. Now, how about Brennan? Brennan, during the investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee of CIA torture, had his people hack into the Senate Intelligence Committee computers to see what kind of information they were preparing in their investigation. He initially denied that anyone did that. Then he had to admit, yes, I didn't know about it, but of course they did. So what you have is two people with very dubious reputations for veracity. And what Representative Nunes is doing, and I applaud him for this, is making sure that he gets his ducks in a row, that he has the evidence that he needs to ask them genuine questions, lest they prevaricate, lest they lie again under oath.
One of the points you make in the article is that President Obama cowered before the intelligence community. And I wanted to ask you how so, and how did that impact what's happening now?
So what happened was the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence had completed a four-year report investigating CIA torture using CIA documents. This was a deal that CIA Director Panetta made with the Senate Intelligence Committee. They had the documents. They came to the conclusion that incredibly gruesome, incredibly unconscionable techniques were used to no good effect. There was no good intelligence coming from it. And so John Brennan and everyone else who claimed that these things were effective were lying through their teeth, sometimes under oath. Now, Brennan did all he could to block the appearance of that executive summary of that report until such time as the Republicans came in and took over the Senate. The person that blocked that were two people. It was Dianne Feinstein, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the Senate minority leader, the fellow from Nevada. Okay? Now, who are they fighting against? They wanted this report released before they lost the chair. They were fighting not only against John Brennan, they were fighting against Barack Obama. Now, why was Barack Obama protecting John Brennan and trying to prevent us from learning about the terrible techniques used by the CIA? You tell me, but it's a matter of record. the chief examiner, the chief investigator of Dianne Feinstein's Senate Intelligence Committee, has told a reporter in many interviews, a reporter for The Guardian, that this is exactly what happened. So this is just one instance where Barack Obama bowed to the intelligence community. He never followed up on any of the torturers. He never closed Guantanamo. He was afraid. He was afraid of what might happen to him were he to cross the intelligence community. A recent, an incredible revelation occurred just about a month ago when the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer from New York, told Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, he said this, and this is a direct quote. "You know, Rachel, I thought that Donald Trump was a pretty smart guy, but he's done a very, very foolish thing." And she said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, he's crossing the CIA. That's a very foolish thing to do because they have 6 ways to Sunday to get back at you." "You know, I thought he was a clever fellow," says Chuck Schumer, "but I really question his wisdom now because you don't cross the CIA. Now, I submit to you that that's the head of the Democrats in the Senate. And he's saying this in the open to Rachel Maddow, but Rachel is too smart to ask the follow-up question, which should have been, of course, "Are you saying that the President of the United States should be afraid of the CIA? Is that what you're saying, Senator Schumer?" And he would have had to answer that. But no, she's, "Oh, we're going to break now," in traditional fashion. So people are afraid of the CIA. And what's happened now is evidence has been adduced to show that Obama's people were spying on Trump's people. And that evidence has been given to the head of the House Intelligence Committee. He's seen it. And now the last thing is that the White House has invited the ranking member and the chair of each committee, House and Senate Intelligence Committee, to come to the White House and view these documents, which show, in my view, that intercepted messages are quite clear that Obama's people were monitoring Trump's people, and that true names were used. And here's where the crime comes in. The crime comes in when those names like Michael Flynn, who lost his job because of this, are released to the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, I have a good guess as to who did that. I'll give you his initials, John Brennan, head of the CIA.
So your article is titled "The Surveillance State Behind Russiagate." That's what you're talking about. The fact that underneath all of this is the issue that there is a surveillance state, and not only were people surveilled, but these names that aren't supposed to be released were released.
That's correct. And it was done for political reasons. First off, to make sure that Trump didn't win. And then after he did win, to make sure the Electoral College didn't vote for him to win, and when that failed, to blacken him in such a way for two major reasons. One, to explain how Hillary Clinton lost. Now, nobody expected her to lose, and there's the equivalent of PTSD here in this town, in Washington, and elsewhere. How do you explain it couldn't possibly be that Hillary Clinton was a fatally flawed candidate? It couldn't possibly be that nobody trusted her. It must have been, let's blame it on the Russians, okay? Now, that's number one. Russians, a convenient scapegoat, even as I said at the beginning of this interview, there is not a scintilla of evidence that it was the Russians that were responsible for either big leak, the DNC or the Podesta emails. And number two, I hold no brief for Trump. I think his domestic policies are terrible, okay? But even a broken clock is right 2 times a day. Now, Trump happens to be quite right on an issue of transcendent importance, and that issue is forming a decent relationship with the Russians. There is no reason why the tensions that have been stoked under the Obama regime need to persist. So what is happening now is that the people who profiteer on these tensions, the people that Pope Francis, when he was here, remember when he talked to Congress and he said, the main problem is the blood-soaked arms traders. Well, that's what you've got in spades here. If there's peace, if Trump works out a decent relationship by talking to the Russians, well, peace is not good for business, Esther. War tensions with Russia are very, very convenient for the arms makers, the arms dealers, who make huge profits, who give a share of those profits to congressmen and senators. They stick it in their back pockets. They use it to win their next campaign. They appropriate more money for the arms trade. Man, is this a great country or what? That's the way it works.
Well, I'm kind of running out of time, but I want to get your sense about what's going to happen now. You feel that the ball is kind of in Trump's court to play in terms of whether he will also cower before the intelligence community.
That's exactly right. That's a very good question, Esther. And, you know, I won't even hazard a guess. All I want to highlight here is that he's been given a very unwelcome choice here. He's been confronted. Matter of fact, the head of the House Intelligence Committee invited the head of the FBI to come and talk with him one-on-one on Tuesday, and the head of the FBI refused. Now, that's really important. Who's running this country? Is it the Congress that has these powers of oversight, which really they haven't used very much lately, or is it the FBI? So what's going to happen now is both of the intelligence committees are going to be given access to this very sensitive material that only Representative Nunes, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, has seen so far. Now, that's going to be really interesting, because when they see that, there's going to be no way they can avoid forcing the issue. Either they admit that Trump has been spied upon, or they continue to resist, and then the ball is really in Trump's court. Will he face into the deep state, or will he acquiesce and have them as a shadow over his tenure, whether it's 4 years or 8 years for Obama? Sadly, it was 8 years.
All right. Well, we will definitely keep following this story. I've been speaking with Ray McGovern, a veteran CIA officer turned political activist who founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity in 2003. Thank you, Ray.
You're most welcome, Esther.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Avaram. Well, the 11th Street Bridge Park Community Land Trust Program, which will allow people to acquire and own property in a collective, was the subject of a forum this week in the Anacostia section of D.C., which is home to some of the poorest people in the district and the nation. But the neighborhood is also threatened by gentrification and displacement. Following are voices of those who participated on the panel: Robert Burns of City First Homes, Kimon Freeman of WEAC Radio, Zach Murray of Grounded Solutions Network, and Bob Reeder of Rural List.
The traditional land trust, when it started, going back in the history of the land trust movement, was based around the theory of contiguous land and a lot of the cooperative spirit that really came out of this. A lot of them started in rural areas, and that was part of the movement itself. And Kimon's exactly right. You find a lot of urban areas around the country where because you can't have contiguous land, you can absolutely have scattered site community land trusts, and they exist in multiple cities around the country. So there's example after example of that. There are a lot of cities around the country that are looking at this as a model. So it's a growing area. New York City is one of the latest large cities to start looking at it as a model. So Zach, would you like to add in?
Contribute. I think a good example of scattered site that I can name would be in San Francisco, the San Francisco Community Land Trust. It's also relevant, I think, to D.C. because it's a high-cost community that has been struggling with issues of displacement, particularly the Black community. And they're running units all across the city. And I think a lot of folks who are interested in community land trusts, for example, in Baltimore, they're in conversations to not just launch, but really initiate and get housing for community land trusts. And one of the difficulties is they want to do it in the same block, but a lot of the properties aren't there. And so they're trying to figure out how to make it work in a place where there are a lot of vacancies and things like that. I think in terms of the funding, it's really important actually to leverage government more effectively. And so we look at some of the like stabilization properties, for example, and how those are being funneled to groups that or to lenders who basically are stealing folks' property. You know, the mortgages are being given away. Folks are not being allowed to retain their asset. And I really think that community land trust is a much more stabilizing model when it comes down to it for helping folks to retain the asset. And if they can't, to figure out how to at least keep them in the property.
Yeah, I don't have too much more to add, except that I wanted to highlight the leverage component that was mentioned. And also to, again, shout out the private philanthropy that also was so emblematic of what's coming, public-private partnerships and the leverage that allows us to assemble the kinds of just asset bases we need to do this work.
And I think also in the conversation about access to capital is that, again, when I was working at Greenlining, we pushed them a lot on the community land trust issue and the question. And the reality is the banks don't have much knowledge, and so they need advocates to come forward and to really, I think, communicate the benefits of CLT and why it's important that more bankers and more banks are investing in that model for community development.
Thank you. That was a great first question.
What's the possibility of using community land trust in conjunction with the TOPA in the district or even public housing?
And if I may, if somebody could explain TOPA for people that might not understand.
So it's the Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act. And D.C. is actually, I think, a really important model for this in terms of providing folks who are in a unit, you know, when the owner decides to sell, the tenants have the ability to put in their bid to make an effort to purchase, and this exists in other communities, including Boston. I think I would add one other thing, which is low-income tax credit properties as well, is that, you know, we're funding these things to provide affordable housing only for a certain amount of time. And so it becomes an inefficient use of resources to every 15 to 30 years have to reinvest, recapitalize. And so I think that those are important models that have to be leveraged by the community land trust. We have to figure out ways to retain the affordability permanently, because we know that, you know, as Kimon said, folks can't afford to live here anymore, and there aren't many opportunities, I think, you know, figuring out ways to ensure that capital is available for folks to maintain affordability should be paramount.
So the historical perspective is that's exactly what, and it's been a long time. It had to be 25 years ago, but that's what we did at New Columbia Community Land Trust to acquire our properties. On the way over here, my colleague Adam and I were having a conversation about in an area like the District of Columbia that where there could be no annexation, land is finite, every decision, every contemplation about anything related to land is political. And so there was this really push in the northwest side before this became desirable to just cleanse neighborhoods. And landlords were trying every way they could. They would shut off power. They were bringing in gang people to terrorize folks. But because of this, the first option to purchase, we were able to partner with another group who's no longer around, Washington City Self-Help, who would organize the residents to say, let's look at cooperatives and community land trusts as a way of ensuring that you will always be able to, not just you, which is another piece that we need to bring out, your children and your grandchildren will always be able to stay in this neighborhood.
I just add one other aspect of TOPA. One of the partnership aspects of working with 11th Street Bridge Park is that there has been an effort through this partnership to identify buildings in the bridge impact area who would be interested potentially in exercising their TOPA rights, which is an important aspect. It gets to Bob's point that often the buildings not necessarily are aware of their TOPA rights, but need to be organized as well. So there's already some upfront work to identify buildings that might be able to fit the model of TOPA on potentially community land trust land. And that's an important aspect of the front end to be able to acknowledge that.
I just want to make sure everyone was on the same page, that you understand that the community land trust would be impervious to market prices, which means you would pay a fair price for what you're doing. It's not a competitive, free market, you know, race to the bottom with the community land trust. It also means that somebody's not going to make as much money. And the somebody that's not going to make as much money are very powerful people. So there are obstacles that need to be overcome. And that's why we're on this campaign to educate as many people as we possibly can so that we can build support bases. Because actually, the government is responsible for what we see. The government has policies that can either preserve or get rid of. And that's what we're here to do today, is also do for self, but also get your support. So I want to make sure that everyone walks out of here knowing that they're either going to be an advocate or they're going to be an obstacle.
The irony of that land trust being called New Community, and we have a New Communities here in D.C., which is the exact opposite of what's going on here, was not lost on me. And so many of you may want to check that out. It's coming from the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development. And so one of the largest landholders is public housing here in D.C. And New Communities has 4 sites that they're redeveloping without this kind of concept in mind at all. And everything is very accelerated now. So every moment counts. Right now, Berry Farm is being redeveloped. It's not a land trust model. Neither are the other 3 slated redevelopments coming from New Communities with our tax dollars. I want to add this as a question and as a comment. United Medical Center on Southern Avenue, 17 acres of land. They're in conversation right now about getting rid of the hospital. Vincent Gray is kind of pushing this, getting rid of the hospital, moving it somewhere else so that land can be put into play on the private market.
Sorry, Vincent is for moving the hospital?
I will notify you of that right now, yes.
Wow. I just want to say for the record, I covered an event at the United Medical Center last summer, and he said directly the opposite.
Well, that's politics for you, brother.
Okay, just want to put that on record.
So my point is this. Given the limited land that we have in D.C., given the political will and the how politicians tend to shift with the winds, what can we do to ensure that 17 acres does not go into that kind of competitive a marketplace, but more into the land trust model? And is there any opportunity to salvage New Communities to make it something that's really relevant and a leg up for our poorest D.C. residents?
For those who do not know, is there any developers in the house? Raise your hand if you does. I have a developer friend. 2 of my friends are developers. It's okay. Okay. All right. Okay. We are not against development. We're against displacement. 2 different things. It's not a natural occurrence. But when new development comes to this town, some of them get 10-year tax breaks to attract them to come here. I want to make sure everyone is aware of that. They get all kinds of breaks to attract them here, but there's nothing in place to keep small businesses. Some people will know them as mom and pop shops. You might have never heard of them because they don't exist. But there's nothing in place to preserve them here. And if the deputy mayor was here, he would say, oh, well, we have a great streets program, which gives you a nice facelift so you don't look out of place as a new development comes in and they build all around you. I got one myself, thank you. But it's not a grant, it's a loan. My business partner's father in Chicago had to mortgage his house to get us this new facelift renovation that hopefully you would join us on April 18th for our fundraiser. But there's nothing in place for the city to preserve us. So Brian Kenner, nice guy, I love his shoes, but he was asked this pointed question, what is the city doing to preserve longtime residents and small businesses? And after he gave the Great Street Grant, you know, response, they pushed him further. And he said, okay, well, that's great, but what is that doing to preserve them affording the cost of being here? And he says, oh, well, we can't subsidize every small business in the city. I take exception to that. And we're showing you ways that they could do that. They've done all kinds of subsidies for large developers, large businesses. Anybody remember the deal in Walmart?
Yeah.
Do everyone aware what happened? Okay. So basically, there's either an advocate side to this or obstacle side to this. And we're here to funnel as much information to create more advocates so that the city can do what they should be doing for the community that they're supposed to serve.
I think there are a couple of useful examples. The state of California has a law that mandates that if you're selling public land, affordable housing has to be prioritized. I think that's something that should be considered here in D.C., given the affordability crisis, that you know, if you're dispensing public land, that affordable housing has to be priority number one. And actually, advocates in the city of Oakland were able to stall a development that the city was basically giving away with no bid, and it included no affordable housing in the first iteration. The advocates brought forward that law and were able to force the city and the developers back to the drawing board, and ultimately they ended up with something like 140 affordable units that are built next to the market rate development.
Just to clarify, New Communities is an affordable housing scheme. It's a mixed income scheme, so it increases density. It replaces the same amount of units that were already there, but increases those units that are market rate.
Absolutely. And you mentioned public housing and the redevelopment. We know all across the country that public housing is being redeveloped, only there are not enough units being built to allow folks to return. And so I think demanding a right to return in affordable properties, not just public housing, but affordable properties in general, is also an important thing that advocates should get behind, that folks should have the right on public land to return to the affordable rate that they were paying on that land.
Thank you. So I don't want to be too cynical, but someone mentioned a few moments ago that some firms didn't act in the best way with regards to ownership of property before. And during the housing crisis, J.P. Morgan Chase illegally foreclosed on many homes, including homes of soldiers, and their primary responsibility is towards their shareholders. So how do we know that their interest is in the community and not in their profits?
We have no permanent friends or permanent enemies.
I mean, their primary responsibility is still towards their shareholders.
This is definitely a question for City First Enterprise, but I just want to say that you're welcome and we act radio anytime for our happy hours from 5 to 8. We like your spunk and spirit. We need to speak truth to power and not cower at that. That's a very relevant question. I just want to say that there are municipal bondholders in every city who the council and city officials answer to. And how do I know this? Because a few years ago, we was fighting for Save Our Safety Net social service programs, because whenever the city has a deficit, what's the first thing they cut? Programs that benefit poor people, okay? Because it's less outrage about that. But when they have a surplus, do you hear about social services going up? No. And so what happened was we were saying, well, instead of cutting social services, why don't we preserve this safety net and institute a progressive income tax, okay? And in D.C., the top tax bracket is $40,000. So whether you make $40,000 or $80,000 or $800,000 or $4 million, you're paying the same percentage in taxes, which is much higher burden on the $40,000 salary than the $4 million salary. So if you have a budget shortcoming, why not have a tier system with the taxes? A progressive income tax goes up a little bit as your income goes up. Wouldn't that be fair? And take that money you make from that and put that to preserve the social safety net programs. We had a vote of 7-6 on the council to win this, okay? Vincent Gray was the chairman of the council at the time, and he whispered into Yvette Alexander's ear on the council, and she switched the vote. So now it's 6-7. And ironically, you saw how he repaid her for that favor. Okay. He took her seat, you know, when he needed it. But he said from the council chambers that if we were to institute this progressive income tax, our municipal bondholders would go crazy and our bond rating would go down. And I, in my ignorance, was like, what has bondholders got to do with... Their shareholders, and they're beholden to them. So I'm not going to defend banks, but the problem is a very deep rabbit hole. And you alluded to that, and you're welcome to React Radio for drinks on Wednesdays from 5 to 8.
So let me, I want to give a broader response and appreciate the questions overall that have been asked. J.P. Morgan, on a larger national scale, local scale, has a deep commitment to affordable housing across the country. And we're certainly appreciative of the work they've done here. And I think all institutions across the country have had lessons since the housing crisis have occurred. Not only do they support the efforts here, they support grounded solutions, and I can cite housing organizations all across the country. Support comes from multiple sources, and it's going to come from multiple sources in order to leverage that from all types of organizations. Zach, did you want to say?
Yeah, I guess I would say that in this case, I feel the ends justify the means. I mean, we're talking about a community land trust. This is about democratizing the land and providing the ability for folks to afford ownership, to afford to gain equity and access to what everyone else has. You know, there are folks in D.C. who are absolutely benefiting from this economy, homeowners, folks who are getting a rise. You know, you have thousands of paper millionaires in California. You know, we have to figure out where we can leverage, you know, the opportunities where they are. I've worked in places where we advocated that Chase Bank, Wells Fargo, on down the list, that they improve their numbers. We haven't seen the type of progress that I think we want to see. You're absolutely right. The numbers, you know, in terms of mortgage lending to communities of color are absolutely depressing. And in some cases, they've only gotten worse since 2008 because folks are just not putting the capital out there. And so I think what Community Land Trust does is it helps to provide a model of ownership that grants folks initial access. There's research that shows that after 5 years, you know, that folks are, the average tenure in a land trust unit is 5 years. And after that 5 years, folks have equity to then pay a down payment in a home that they can own on their own. So it's, you know, it's an opportunity for folks, you know, when it's leveraged correctly. But I think the most important takeaway point is that the CLT is nothing, obviously, without the community. And so if the community is at the table and in the leadership of a CLT, you know, you're pushing the types of results I think the community wants to see.
We're going to have time for one more question, and she's right behind me.
Hi, I don't live in this ward. I don't live in this region of the country. I'm from Chicago. but I wanted to mention, I mean, the only reason, God bless J.P. Morgan Chase and being here, I don't want to disparage that, but the only reason banks invest in neighborhoods of color or in disadvantaged neighborhoods or disinvested neighborhoods is because of the Community Reinvestment Act and the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and the work of pioneers in the early 70s who fought to stop redlining. And they have great people that work at banks, but they are only doing it because of the Community Reinvestment Act, which, as an aside, is possibly threatened by the current administration. But earlier the question was asked, do you think it's better for rental, homeownership, or commercial community land trust? How about all three, and are there examples of community land trusts where they have this comprehensive? Because we're worried. We're here to inform our work around the country. I work for a national nonprofit, but we're worried about businesses not being able to get started up or stay because the business that rents their space on a storefront gets displaced right after the residents who live upstairs.
I'll start, and certainly happy. There are wonderful examples around the country where community land trusts have taken the larger view that it is about all different aspects of the community, whether that be the entire housing continuum from rental to ownership, including supportive housing, which DC has a critical need for. The same applies to commercial as well as community facilities. And great examples that I'm aware of, one I cited earlier, which is Champlain Housing in Burlington, Vermont, largest land trust in the country, has excellent examples of community facilities, rental, and ownership. Another great one is in Denver, Colorado, which is the Urban Land Conservancy. They set out with the original mission of being able to look at this as a way to reach out to businesses, small businesses, which we all know are being displaced in neighborhoods around the city and cities around the country, but as a way to look at that, because it is about the entire community, and that's part of the community land trust. It's not just about one form of housing. But those are a couple of examples, and there are others that I would cite. Zach may have more.
I would say there are a number of land trusts right now that are stewarding rental units, inclusionary units, and there's some successful models there, also in Boulder and in San Francisco. I think with the commercial, which I think is incredibly important, you know, in terms of legacy businesses and businesses that have been around and that are comfortable to the residents who are currently there, when those businesses leave, residents lose their comfort, lose their source of food, of all kinds of things. You know, one other model that I would suggest is also in San Francisco is the legacy. They set aside a few million dollars, I think, to preserve businesses. The oldest black bookstore in the country, Marcus Books, was shuttered for a number of years because the landlord ran the rent up. Well, now that bookstore is back open due to that program.
Yeah, I would just ditto the fact that it's inclusive, it's comprehensive, it's about place. And what kind of place do we want to create and sustain and have? And certainly those places entail or encompass all of the above. So
I just want to say that ideally, the perfect scenario would be the tried and true development we've seen already. You know, the building with the condos or the apartments upstairs and the retail on the first floor. I would like to see, you know, a community space in there as well. If it's going to be a co-op, we got to have some room to have collective actual work being done. This is the essence of community, as opposed to you and your job at your garage and you don't know your neighbor. So this is what we're talking about, community, and that's what gets the information out. That's what gets the word out. And I want to speak to the challenge of reaching the community. As running a progressive radio station in Anacostia, very few people in the neighborhood listen to our station. We get calls from all around the country, but not around the corner. And one of the things I've learned in the past 5 years is that there's a certain type of mentality with the working poor, the people who don't have disposable income, the people who don't have annual leave, the people who may work two shifts. They have very little mental space for anything other than this survival mentality, especially when those who've been yes, there's a conditioning, even when someone's saying, what is this? Yeah. So there, we can't expect the people who are actually been victimized the most to do all the work because something has been done to them. All right. And so that's the conundrum that we have. And we hopefully will have more advocates than obstacles as we move forward.
So I'm going to have one final question. What are some of the things that the community can do to help to support or advocate for the community land trust model?
I would challenge everyone in this room to call or visit. I would prefer visit your council member and ask them, what are they doing to preserve long-time residents and small businesses in this city? And then wait for the response. And it's going to sound kind of like that. And then say, well, did you know about community land trust?
Do collaborative so that for this council meeting, you go. For the next council meeting, you go. For the next planning board meeting, I'll go. And then we kind of informally come around and figure out what's going on so we can react as opposed to react.
Yeah, I agree with and echo everything that's been said. Showing up is incredibly important. I think also what I recommend is for the advocates and residents of this community to really applaud yourselves for getting this far in the process, right? The community land trust is on the table. Now band together and do what it takes to make it happen. I think this community is on the right path to preserving what we have here in Anacostia.
I just want to make sure that they understand that this is not just a moral obligation. You should go out and do the right thing. There's also some self-motivation in this as well. We're saying that you should not be paying more than 30% of your income in housing. That's the federal guideline. Why not be a mandate? We can also put a cap on these prices here. You know, let's start that conversation. Let's talk about how this is one of the most expensive places to be. I think it's already been confirmed as the most expensive place to raise children. So when we all have been exploited in this developer's dream right now, and we all are in this together. And housing, I dare say, from my favorite First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, is a human right, all right? And it's applicable to healthcare, that they run like a business. And we need to sidestep that. I think this is part of the biggest struggle. And I think that we start right here with the housing issue, and it would really snowball to a lot of other things that would be beneficial to the common good.
Let's give a hand for these amazing panelists.
You've been listening to a forum about the 11th Street Bridge Park Community Land Trust Program held March 29, 2017 in the Anacostia section of Washington, D.C. Speakers included Robert Burns of City First Homes, Kimone Freeman of WEAC Radio, Zach Murray of Grounded Solutions Network, and Bob Reeder of Rural LISC. And that will do it for today's show. Thanks to our guests, Ray McGovern and Gerald Horn. Also, thanks to Lydia Curtis and Michelle Roberts for their reporting. This is On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Verum. Keep raising your voice.